All right, so I assume everyone knows what the hierarchy problem is and its various solutions. I'm just gonna jump straight into it. And so what I'm going to be doing today is sort of a new approach towards solving the hierarchy problem. And the real approach is really trying to do something like self-organized criticality. So if the sort of standard example of self-organized criticality is sand dunes. And so if you just take sand and just sprinkle it in a box, eventually you get these, the attractive late time behavior is forming these sand dunes where dropping a single sand has a large probability of just causing the whole thing to cascade down. And this is, people have just simulated it and showed that sand dunes very naturally form. And it's sort of an interesting point because it just, as you take time to infinity, it just naturally flows to a critical point where it's very like right on the edge of some drastic behavior. And the idea is just try to apply something like that to the Higgs boson. And so what's the late time attractor? It's just the absolute minimum of the theory. And so what I want to do is basically say, even though the Higgs mass is large at any generic point in field space, the minimum will adjust itself such that at the minimum, there's going to be a small Higgs mass. So the idea is basically say, just let the Higgs get a large quadratic divergence. There's gonna be some other terms, but it's just that when you expand the Higgs around its minimum in terms of some small perturbations, you get a very small mass. And so you can say these words and it would be, some sense very surprising if it does work. I guess the statement is just over most of field space, the second derivative is very large, but it's just that right at the minimum, it's abnormally small. Note that this is not the Goldstone approach, right? The Goldstone approach is basically you start off with a very small mass and then you break shift symmetries slightly. This is the, in some sense, the opposite. I just start with a large Higgs mass. And so is this idea completely crazy, right? Because if you say the words, you'd be like, sure, I'd like it if it was true, but a theory of this actually existing sounds pretty unlikely. And in fact, for something like this cosmological constant, Weinberg has a no-go theorem that says that you can't relax the CC to zero. However, it's not as crazy as it sounds because we actually know of a field theory example of relaxation. And it's given by the dilaton. So it's when people talk about the dilaton, they usually do not formulate it or talk about relaxation. But it is true that some standard examples like Goldberg or Wise actually do realize this sort of relaxation. And so the idea behind the dilaton is you start off with scale invariance. And so your field phi has exactly field dimension one. And you can write down a coupling that's allowed by symmetries, which is the quartic interaction. So this is going to be my proxy for a number that should be very large, but will be dynamically relaxed to be very small near the minimum. So the equivalent of the hierarchy problem is just that this coupling should be large, because if you calculate RG corrections or the corrections from just coupling to matter, you generate quartic terms. And so you expect this number here to be large in order one. And right, there's no symmetry forbidding it, so it should be order one, the standard.
What do you call dilaton here?
So it's gonna be the spontaneous breaking of scale invariance. And so sometimes you might call this phi e to the I, phi over f.
Yeah.
So it depends on what your notation is. Sometimes this is an exponential. Or I guess there's no I, it's just e to the phi over f. Yeah. Talking about the dilaton by itself is, well, it's not that useful because if this quartic is positive, the minimum is at zero, so conformal symmetry is never broken. And if it's negative, phi runs off to infinity and conformal symmetry is always broken. So what people do is they add an operator here that has dimension four minus epsilon, and that destabilizes the origin epsilonically. Right, this is the ADS-CFT dual of Goldberger-Wise. And so what you can do is take this potential now, expand it around the minimum. So you take your field phi, expand around some VEV F, with some small perturbations. And then if you take the small epsilon limit of the result, what you get is that a small mass term, but you'll notice that the quartic here is also very small. It's of order m squared over f squared. So despite the fact that you had in your theory right here a large order one tree level quartic, when you expand around the minimum, the quartic turns out to be very, very small. And so this is an example, though not typically phrased this way, of basically dynamically relaxing a value of something. So in this case, it's the value of a quartic coupling. And the example I'm going to talk about later is doing the same thing with the Higgs mass, though unfortunately, it will not be as clean as the dilaton. It will be messy. But the philosophy is exactly the same. And the way the sort of cancellation of divergences and whatnot is exactly the same as the dilaton, right? Because if you shift this quartic by some order one amount, what happens is that the minimum shifts by some order one amount, and the quartic at the minimum stays small again. Okay.
The epsilon is in F, or?
Epsilon is just the, well, so essentially F is, has, essentially what happens is F is proportional to something like A over F to the 1 over epsilon power.
Okay.
Yeah.
What happens to the quartically divergent radiative corrections, which is the source of the...
Yeah, so because the theory is scale invariant, the logarithmic corrections and everything just give you a quartic coupling, right? Because you take log of phi times mu over like mass times phi. And so the phi is canceled in the log, and you just get large finite corrections to the quartic coupling.
So there's no quartic divergence.
It's different from the standard, the Higgs, in that it's not a quadratically divergent correction or anything. It's just large finite corrections. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, okay, so let's get to talking about the Higgs version. So the idea is to say, well, I guess the lasers, oh no, it's working. Imagine that the Higgs mass is controlled by the VEV of some scalar. So this happens all the time, right? In the MSSM, in any two Higgs doublet model, twin Higgs, the relaxion, multiverse, and naturalness, whatever. Basically, if you have another scalar in the theory, as you move its scalar VEV, it'll change the Higgs mass locally. And so I'm just going to call this scalar a modulus. You can call it whatever you want. And so the idea is to try to arrange so that the minimum of the modulus is such that even if you have a large Higgs mass that's there, it gets naturally canceled around the minimum to be a small value. So if you think about this for a while, you'll notice that it'll turn out to be very, very difficult. The reason is that if the modulus only couples to the Higgs mass, then it's very easy to show that a small Higgs mass is always a maximum and not a minimum. So that if you want to actually get a small Higgs mass, it's the wrong sign. It's not a minimum. It's at best a maximum. And so that means your modulus has to couple to more than just a Higgs mass. So essentially the statement is, if you look at the integrate out the Higgs at tree level, its contribution to the vacuum energy is negative m Higgs to the fourth if the Higgs mass is negative, and if it's positive, then it's just zero because you set the Higgs VEV to zero. And so if you look at that, that always has a negative second derivative. And so if you're near the origin, negative mh to the fourth is a maximum and not a minimum. And so if you're literally just dialing around the Higgs mass, it only ends up, a small Higgs mass is always a maximum and not a minimum.
Yeah, the reason we don't have a problem with fermions is because when the fermion mass goes to zero, you restore a
chiral symmetry, yeah.
So in order to, we don't have such a symmetry for scale.
That's correct.
So are you inventing a symmetry?
No. Just like in the case for the dilaton, right? In some sense, if you ask me, why is the quartic coupling small around this minimum? The answer is, I can calculate it and show it to you, but I don't have a good physical explanation.
It must have been the smallest of epsilons, right? If you translated your m into a and epsilon, what would it look like? M over f, what's that term?
So let's see. So f is basically a over lambda to the 1 over epsilon power. M is proportional to like lambda times f, or something like that, I believe.
What's that?
The quartic coupling. Yeah.
So you're not destabilizing the electric wave vacuum.
Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, in the end, I'm going to try to get the Higgs mass as light as possible, but just like the dilaton case, what will mess up, like how close I can set the Higgs mass will be beta functions. And unlike the case of some unknown CFT where you can take epsilon as small as you want, in the standard model, beta functions are well measured, and we know they're one loop suppressed. And so I will only be able to make the Higgs mass one loop lighter than you would have expected, because I can't take the equivalent of the epsilon to goes to zero limit. One loop lighter than the bare mass that you give it, whatever that may be, whether it's from quadratic divergence or some other source, whatever. Yeah.
I can't do math in my head. So the basic knob you're turning is you're making epsilon small.
Yes, that's right.
So that's a fine tuning.
In some sense, right? Like this, in the standard model, epsilon is 1 over 16 pi squared times loop factors, right? We know the RG of L, and I wouldn't call the fact that beta functions are small fine-tuned. I mean, it is true that, so that's in the standard model, but in this case, like the fact that there exists this operator is non-trivial. Whether or not you call it fine-tuning or not, that's a matter of opinion. I don't really care about the dilaton a huge amount, but we can, I guess, discuss issues of fine-tuning for the actual model.
Why don't you continue?
Yeah. Okay. So the way to actually get a small Higgs mass is essentially to use a discrete symmetry. And so the discrete symmetry, like scale invariance, will let me write a large tree-level mass for the Higgs. And I will just arrange that this large mass just gets relaxed to zero near the minimum. OK. So my starting point is going to be a Zn symmetry. In practice, all I need is n greater than or equal to 3. So you, as a theorist, I like putting n arbitrary, but in practice, you just set it to 3. So you can imagine you have 3 copies of the Higgs that are sort of cyclically exchanged under the Zn symmetry. So 1 goes to 2, 2 goes to 3, 3 goes back to 1. And so the modulus is going to be a periodic scalar. So phi equals phi plus 2 pi f. It's just some angular variable. And I'm going to take the shift symmetry to be broken down to the sort of periodic nature by a spurion that's of dimension 2, some epsilon squared. Epsilon is, I guess, not actually going to be a small number, but oh well. bad choice of labeling, I guess. All right. So under the Zn symmetry, I'm going to say this periodic scalar goes to itself plus 2 pi f over n, right? So instead of going a full 2 pi, it goes to 2 pi over n. So obviously, if you apply the Zn n times, you go back to itself. So it nonlinearly realizes the Zn symmetry. Okay, so at this point, you just write down the most general Lagrangian consistent with all of the symmetries, right? I'm an effective field theorist. I just write down everything that's allowed. So because I like doing things analytically, I'm going to actually ignore cross-quartics. But if you do things numerically, you can show that the cross-quartics won't change the story.
Can I ask you,
yeah.
Are you assuming that the Higgs couples to fermions? So there's going to be one linear combination, right?
For now, I'm not going to put in the standard model.
Okay.
I'll talk about that later.
Okay.
And it is quite unfortunate that due to various things, I'll actually need three copies of the standard model. So that's very unpleasant. I would much prefer just to have three copies of the Higgs and nothing else.
Yeah, yeah.
But,
that's why I was asking,
yeah.
Because I was expecting that because of the symmetry, it would require...
yeah.
Okay, but okay.
Yeah, for now, let's just consider we have three doublets and then... don't talk about anything else for now.
And the reason you're not considering quartz is because they can be redefined? Is there a
No. So I guess I'm first going to say the story with no cross-quartics.
Yeah.
And then my claim is that when you do it numerically, that the cross-quartics will not change the story at all.
Okay.
Which is a non-trivial statement.
Yeah.
It's just that in the limit where the cross-quartics are zero, I can analytically show why the behavior of a small Higgs mass results. Whereas when you do it for a cross-quartics, you can't do it analytically anymore. And so you just have to do it numerically, and then you don't have that good intuition. Yeah.
The rules are that phi only appears in the mass, not in the other parameters.
So there's the cross-quartics. And so the question is, why does the modulus only couple to the mass? And the origin of that is just, I assumed that there was the spurion had dimension 2. And so the only dimension 2 thing it can couple to is Higgs squared. If you assumed a spurion of dimension 1, you'd have the same thing because there are no odd Higgs to the odd powers. Which
we can't be that over some high scale.
Yeah, so yeah. For now I'm considering all the renormalizable things. If you
But
take,
it's a non-perturbative thing, right? This cosine phi.
You could just say, right, that... So if you're thinking about UV completions,
yeah.
You just say, this is a pseudo-Goldstone, so I have U equals e to the I phi over F.
Yeah, so there's some...
And then it has... This is basically just the VEV of U.
Relevant to your question. The issue here is that this is some U1 type story, but there's some way, now some highly non-trivial way in which the U1 that this potential descends from is intertwined with the Zn,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Zn acts takes you around the U1 manifold. So you have to have some high scale U1 breaking that gives you some cosine, so far so good, but then there has to be some Zn subgroup of that U1. That has to be unbroken in the IR.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So
then somehow
the way you UV complete this is you say I have a Zn, like U goes to U times e to the 2 pi I over N. And then you very easily get an accidental U1. Right, because the only way to break this accidental U1 is take U to the N, which is a very high dimension operator.
Yeah.
And so that's essentially how you get an accidental U1 that is broken in this way. And because it's perturbative, then if you want to look at something that's cosine 2 phi over F, you square this operator, essentially.
As we discussed last week, there is no UV completion right now.
No, I mean, I can write one, yes, if you want, yeah.
I thought
it's very easy to UV complete the structure. I mean, we can talk about it later, but
okay.
To zeroth order, I'd just say I'm a Wilsonian. I write down everything allowed by symmetries, go from there first, right?
Okay.
Sorry, why doesn't that appear as a higher dimension? Well, F is much larger than epsilon and M Higgs, right?
Yes, that's right. So, like, you might imagine that these two parameters are close to your UV cutoff or something.
Yeah.
Right.
Then the argument about throwing away the phi dimension of lambda kind of gets fishy, right? Because if I had a sextic, you know, h Dagger h squared times your spurion suppressed by some m squared, then I'm going to get a shift in lambda, which is order epsilon squared over m squared.
Yeah.
Epsilon.
Yeah. So this is, in the end, I'll only be able to solve this little hierarchy problem. And so all the one loop factors work in my favor. And so I can neglect those. If I had a mechanism that just took it parametrically below the UV cutoff, then yes, I would have to worry. Yeah. The 2 pi's just happen to work my way in this case. But you have to It's also because I only end up being able to solve the little hierarchy problem, getting a loop that the higher dimensional operators end up not being much of an issue.
You have extra scalar Higgs.
Hmm?
You have extra Higgs.
Yeah, so I have two extra Higgses in this case.
If you have extra Higgs, you can show them that when you do the minimum for the potential,
mm-hmm.
you destabilize the the true vacuum. Unless you do a lot of fine-tuning.
Well, let's see what this...
Yeah, so that's actually... I'm going to actually work out the minimum of this model.
Yeah. This is exactly what he's going to do.
So. Yeah. So, I mean, your statement was, I think, the statement I made earlier of just the Higgs mass equals zero looks like is a maximum generally. And so if you do perturbations, you just get pushed off to a large negative mass. And so it seems difficult to do anything.
You write down the equations to get them.
Yeah.
You have more than one.
Mm-hmm.
In order to get the true vacuum, you've got to do fine tuning. This is well known.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Okay.
Unless you're supersymmetry.
Yeah.
He'll show how.
Yeah.
Why don't you?
Let's just. Okay. And so one of the important points is that to note that this modulus couples to each Higgs differently, because if you take H1 to H2, phi goes from phi over f to phi over f plus 2 pi over n. And so this just means that the coupling of each Higgs to each mass is slightly different. But this is just to make the coupling Zn symmetric. So this Zn symmetry, I like it, so I'm never going to break it. There is no explicit breaking. It'll be spontaneously broken by phi obtaining any expectation value, but it is never explicitly broken. Okay, so I'm going to want epsilon squared larger than your mass squared just so that I can take the Higgs mass through zero, right? If I want to have a hope of even selecting a small Higgs mass, the Higgs mass has to actually be able to be small. So I'm going to have epsilon squared over mh squared. If you want to think about this relating to the Higgs, then you think that this is probably the UV cutoff over a loop factor. Okay, so let's actually just work through the minimum, find the minimum of the tree level potential first. So there's going to be some bare potential that you can just write down. And then you get another potential that comes from integrating out the Higgs at tree level. So just setting the Higgses at their minimum, right? So when you set the Higgs at the minimum, right, the mass, the contribution is just negative m Higgs to the fourth over your quartic coupling. And that's true only if you have a theta function if the Higgs mass is negative, right? Because if the Higgs mass becomes positive, the Higgs VeV is at zero, and you get no contribution at tree level to the CC here. Okay, so let's look at this term here. So let's focus on this guy. So we can just expand this, right? So there's a piece that's m Higgs to the fourth, let's see, which is independent of the modulus, so we don't care about it. So in this case, you'll notice I'm throwing out the theta function. So for now, let's just assume that we're in a region of parameter space where all the Higgs masses are negative for now, and then we'll discuss what happens when they become positive. This is independent of the modulus, so all nice and good. You'll notice that this actually sums to zero because essentially you're summing the angles of an equilateral triangle, right? Cosine one is 2 pi, then you go 4 pi, 6 pi, over three. Yeah, and so this sums to zero. And actually this sum of cosine squareds also sums to a constant. It's basically, it's a generalization of sine squared plus cosine squared equals one. And so the statement is this sums to n over 2. And so if all of the Higgs masses are negative, then the potential is completely independent of the moduli, at least the contribution from the Higgses. What happens if one of the Higgs masses is positive? Then instead of summing over 1, 2, and 3 here, you're summing over only two of the legs of a triangle. And that obviously doesn't go back to itself. And so you get something non-zero. And so if you plot this, the statement is just, if you sum over all 1, 2, and 3, these guys are all independent of your modulus. But if you sum over only 1 and 2, because, for example, if the Higgs mass goes positive, the theta function sets it to 0. So then you only sum over 1 and 2. And then you'll notice that this sum does not go to zero, because you're effectively, the reason why the sum over the whole thing went to zero is you're summing over the three legs of a triangle. But now you're only summing over two legs, so it's non-zero. Yeah. And so let's just plot this. And what you get is a large potential that happens to be positive if one of the Higgs masses goes positive. So if one of the three Higgs masses is positive, you get a large tree level potential that just pushes you away. And if all of the Higgs masses are negative, then at tree level, you have no potential at all. So at tree level, you would get a moduli space here if all of the Higgs masses were negative.
This is phi, and this is the potential.
This is phi, and there's just some v of phi in arbitrary units.
Yeah, so what are the red lines here? Are they saying between
these? Between these two, in this flat line here,
okay.
Between those two, all of the Higgs, three Higgs masses are negative.
Okay.
So V1, V2, and V3 are all non-zero.
And then for the high up, it's...
For the high up, one of the three, so this is, let's say, V1 is non-zero, or V1 equals zero. So positive Higgs mass for one,
mm-hmm.
positive Higgs mass for two, positive Higgs mass for three.
Okay.
Because it's Zn symmetric, there are three bumps corresponding to each of the three Higgses.
Is there a symmetry reason for it being flat, or is it just...
No. It is... The cancellation, just these weird sine and cosine identities. There is no reason why it's flat, other than just these accidental sums and cosines summing to constants essentially. And so there really is no symmetry reason why this is flat. And if there was a symmetry reason, then I could keep it flat as much as possible. But I won't be able to keep it as flat as possible because there was no symmetry. Essentially.
And for n bigger than 3, this continues. It's some identities of cosine to
yep.
n minus 1. Over
yeah, there's a huge number of cosine identities. So this one holds for any n greater than 2.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's something that I learned.
Yeah. These are pretty random sine and cosine identities.
And this is where the requirement that you need at least 3 copies comes from?
Yeah, that's right. Because if I only had 2 copies, this would not sum to a constant.
So what happens when you have 2 copies?
If you have 2 copies, you just get a cosine.
Yeah.
And at the minimum, you just get large negative Higgs masses for everyone. Yeah. And so you end up solving nothing in that case.
By the way, there must be a simple way to understand these identities.
So the way to understand these identities is to go to Fourier space. Right, because if you think about it, phi has a Zn symmetry, and so its cosine potential, its like tree level potential, has to be cosine n phi over f. So it has a frequency n over f. But you'll notice that you're just summing up objects that have a frequency 1 over f, and so you need n copies of it. So in this case, right, you only have 2 copies, so you can at best generate a high frequency of 2 over f, and if that's and a potential of only 2 over f is not consistent with your symmetries, so it turns out to have 0 weight. And so you actually generate, this is why you generate these crazy number of sine squared plus cosine squared identities, but also cosine cubed plus sine cubed identities to the fourth, to the fifth, dot, 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 until you're all the way to the n minus 1. And so you generate a huge number of these crazy identities this way. Yeah, it's fun. Okay, so at this point, you'll notice that we've done something special, which is the minimum zero is special, right? Because zero is right on the very edge of moduli space here. So if you can push yourself to the edge of moduli space, then you will have a very small Higgs mass. So what do you do is, I guess here, where did I say it? I wrote down some bare potential. And so let's just write down, add that plot too. So in the black line here, you just have the tree level Higgs contribution. And in the dotted lines, I wrote down basically 2 signs of this other tree level piece. And you'll notice that if you choose the right sign, it's plus or minus, so 50-50 of getting the right sign, you push yourself to all the way to the edge of moduli space. So that means that as you take this tree level bare potential and you just dial it smaller and smaller and smaller, that actually what happens is you get close, at the minimum, you get closer and closer and closer to this The edge of moduli space, which has a small Higgs mass.
Can I ask you something? So the potential, why are the maxima and minima aligned here? There is theta, right? In Lambda, before that you wrote, why are they aligned? I mean, couldn't you just add?
So they could be arbitrarily not aligned. And all that matters is, if you look at just the tree level like contribution, is the minimum of that over here in this range, or is the minimum in this range? If the minimum is in this range, you just get pushed to the edge.
You're saying the center could be a bit it doesn't have to be symmetric.
It doesn't need to be symmetric. I chose the simplest case of actually not just having a Z3 symmetry, but a Z3 times Z2, a phi goes to minus phi.
Yeah, yeah.
So actually the symmetry of the potential I wrote is called D3. It's the symmetries of just a triangle, right? Because you have rotations and then you have a reflection. And so that's why there are six minima that are all identical.
But you're saying that even if the potential was assumed by order one,
then the same structure would
persist.
That's right.
The other question, so the size of the perturbation is of the same order as the overall correction. So
yeah, so how small can I take this tree level?
Yeah.
So
or large.
Or large. So you can take it arbitrarily large, right? You can always just put in a tree level potential that's huge.
Yeah.
But the hope is to try to take it as small as possible so that at the minimum you're as close as possible to the small Higgs mass. And that's going to be the main problem, is that one loop corrections will generate this guy and give an irreducible size to this potential tree level.
I see, that's
potential here.
Yeah.
Okay. So if the beta functions were zero, then I could just dial that number as small as I want and solve the hierarchy problem arbitrarily well. But beta functions are measured in the standard model. I can't set them to zero. So it's somewhat disappointing that I only...
So the bump is created by Coleman-Weinberg.
Yeah, Coleman-Weinberg. This is Coleman-Weinberg.
This is, I think, what Mina was just asking. But if this is detuned, how do you know, like, if it's order one detuned, you'll still have some minimum that's a small mass, but you'll also have a minimum that has negative mass for one of the Higgs.
Yeah, so this is another annoyance, is that at this minimum, the two of the three Higgs masses will be large and negative. So you'll have two very large Higgs VEVs. And because you're sitting slightly off of moduli space, because moduli space has no restoring force, that means the light Higgs mass happens to be positive and not negative. And so it's unfortunate in that regard, yeah.
But then what do you do to break electrovision?
Yeah, so I think I'll actually get to that next.
Okay.
So there's no good way of doing it. I think this was just everything that I said. Okay, yeah, so this was the problem, is that the light Higgs mass is always positive, basically because this tree level moduli space has no restoring force on it. And so you have to go slightly off of it to get a VEV, or to get a minimum, which means you've slightly gone positive Higgs mass. I won't claim that any of my solutions to this are pretty. They're quite ugly. But I just want to mention them to show that there's an existence proof.
So can I?
Yeah.
It's too early to ask this, but what about experimental physics?
Yeah, so I'll get to that in a bit, but this is sort of slowly moving towards it, which is that the light Higgs mass is negative and not positive. So first I'm going to solve that, and then the fact that the other Higgs masses are all large negative Higgs masses means that they can't couple to SU2.
What does that mean, negative?
M squared is less than zero. So I'm colloquially saying Higgs mass being negative. What I really mean is that the VEV is non-zero, or the VEV is zero. Yeah. All right. Okay. So there are two ways of taking this positive Higgs mass and making them negative. None of them are pretty, so I'm just going to go over them rather quickly. The first is, if you just take this potential that I had before, where at the minimum you have a small positive Higgs mass, and in addition to it, you add a high frequency potential, then the effect of this potential that I had originally is to say, whichever minimum is closest to this point is now the true minimum. And if that minimum happens to be slightly to the right, you can move yourself over to a negative Higgs mass. Not particularly present, and the minimum looks something crazy like, or the potential looks something crazy like that, right? And so you've introduced other minima, which is unpleasant, but you still have the feature that at the true minimum, that the Higgs mass is small. And this time it has a small negative.
You have to worry about cosmology now.
So cosmology will be annoying for this. Essentially, because the worry is these bumps might be large enough that you get stuck here, essentially.
Exactly.
Yeah. And I would say from this point of view, it looks like a 50-50 pot shot whether or not I end up in these two versus those two. But I mean, it's not. I don't really know how to quantify that particularly well.
Yeah.
And I think there are other issues that are slightly worse than having the cosmology issues in this model. Yeah.
I mean, is it an issue though? Because if you calculate the tunneling rate and it's pretty fast compared to the transition. Then...
Yeah, so I haven't actually done that. It may be that the tunneling rate is fast and I just won't need to care.
And that could be actually a signature.
Mm-hmm.
So, but there's one right up there, right? There's a minimum right.
Yeah. And the...
No, even at the...
Oh, up there, yeah.
Yeah.
And that's going to be
that's
sorry. Yeah.
Is there any sense to which this adds to the tuning of the model? If you're solving the hierarchy problem, you're kind of aligning.
So these are new problems, essentially. These are technically, as in like they're coincidences of scale. I wouldn't say they're tuning, but since we have like supersymmetry has a lot of mu problems and whatnot, and we know how to solve them. But what it does mean is it introduces more model complexity, for sure.
Yeah, but I mean, there is still a very...
Right, like I said, right, the minimum is to the right or to the left.
There's an amount of knob turning you have to do to get the vacuum.
Yeah, like I said, it's 50-50, right? The nearest minimum could be to the right or to
either,
the left.
Either you do it or you don't. I mean, it's,
yeah.
Have you seen the video about the LHC?
The
LHC. Yeah, the Daily Show.
No, but I mean, right?
Don't worry.
Yeah.
I mean, there is some sense to which you have to adjust the phase of this thing, for example, right? So
like I said, it's like the point of the phase is the nearest minimum to the right or negative Higgs mass or if it's to the left. I'm okay with 50-50 accidents, right?
But sorry, what is the source of this thing? So this is something.
You just have to say at tree level, I add a high frequency potential. Instead of being cosine 3 over f, I'm adding something cosine.
Are you worried about
6 over f or
ZN symmetry?
I'm not. It doesn't break the ZN symmetry because this frequency is a multiple of n.
Okay, so you're making sure.
Yeah. If I ever break the ZN symmetry, this whole story goes to hell and. Everything dies very, very fast.
I mean, I'm confused why it would be 50-50, because if I have a very high frequency perturbation,
then
one is, where does that come from? But let me just charitably put that aside. Then I still have the question of which vacuum do I land in, so then there's some amount of choice.
Mm-hmm.
Or if it's a low frequency addition, then I have to adjust the phase to get the vacuum I want. So there's some degree of knob turning.
Mm-hmm. It's some... Technically natural coincidences, yeah. I mean...
Experimentally, we have to discover these extra particles.
Yeah, and so I'll get to that later. Yeah.
Well, that, without that, you don't have this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, right, the whole point of anything we do is to create experimental predictions, right? Otherwise, you just say it's the standard model to the forever, and then that's that. We should just stop colliders if that's what we believe. And the hope is we'll have some experiment. There will be some experimental signatures. Yeah.
Three more Higgs.
Yeah.
Let's continue.
Okay. The other way of getting a negative Higgs mass is also not particularly pretty. What you do is you just instead of having a Z3, you just have two copies of your Z3. And so then if the same moduli couples to both copies, then at the minimum, instead of having one light positive Higgs mass, you have two light positive Higgs masses. And then you can softly break the new Z2, so that one of the two Higgs masses goes negative and the other is positive. It's not particularly pleasant, but you can do it. All right, So, like I said, if I want to solve the hierarchy problem in all its generality, I need to suppress the tree level one as much as possible. But unfortunately, at one loop, there's another contribution, so I can only solve the little hierarchy problem, right? You can do Coleman-Weinberg sum of m Higgs to the fourth log m Higgs squared over UV cutoff squared. And this is going to be proportional to just some couplings to the fourth over n squared. So since I'm not taking n exponentially large, the one loop contributions are large, and thus I can only solve the little hierarchy problem.
What's stopping you from making n large? I mean, why not? What?
I could. I don't know. I didn't feel like it. I mean, like, there's an issue of just, I guess the main thing is just, because the scaling is n squared and not even n to the fourth or anything like that, the gain you'd go to going to large n is exactly as much as just like random statistics, right? If you randomly select things, you get things smaller by 1 over n squared. And so because if I'm going to take n large, I'd rather just do brute force random statistics than take something like this that requires coincidences of scales and whatnot.
Unless you did it once with
Ed. Yeah. And then you made fun of me enough that I was like, never again.
Now you're a professor.
Yes. Yeah. All right. So the entire story so far, I've been completely agnostic about the other Higgs couplings. And so as long as you put in any Zn invariant coupling, then you're good to go. Because the copies of the Higgs are, these other copies don't necessarily couple to us, they're not really partners in the normal sense, and that they don't cancel the quadratic divergences. So as an example, what you can do is, in the previous theory, is set n equals 3 or 4. You can take the UV cutoff to be about 10 TeV so that the natural value given by quadratic divergences is of order a few TeV. And then you get a light Higgs mass of 100 GeV. There's an issue of what else needs to transform under this Zn symmetry or Z3 symmetry. And because each other Higgs has a large negative value, a large VeV, they contribute to the W and Z boson. And so what we need to do is just copy SU2s so that each doublet has its own SU2. Now, unfortunately, because the other Higgses have different SU2s, they can't couple to our quarks when we try to ZNFI the Yukawa interactions. And so we also must have to duplicate the quarks and leptons. And each of these are about a factor of 10 heavier than their standard model partners. This is essentially the loop factor, or the square root of a loop factor, yeah. And then, because they're only a factor of 10 heavier, then that means the copy of the up quark would be, instead of 5 MeV, it would be like 50 MeV. And so that we don't see those. And so we don't see them in colored, and we don't see them in electrically charged. And so you also have to duplicate SU3 and U1. And so unfortunately, you have to have three completely separate copies of the standard model in the model as written. So
for Khabibov flavor mixing, there is no.
Yeah, so I couldn't make this Z3 the three flavors. Mm-hmm. Basically, if I needed to make that work out, I would need very specific sine and cosine identities to be true for the masses and the mixing angles, and which just don't seem to be. I agree, that would have been awesome if the Z3 was just literally the copies of the flavors. Yeah. So since we actually care about finding things, what is the phenomenology of this model? So I hadn't put in cross-cortex, but the entire story I mentioned goes entirely through if you include cross-cortex. You get very similar signatures to that of twin Higgs, but if you just look at the numerical values, the mixings tend to be smaller than twin Higgs. And so The only thing that actually has to couple to the standard model is this moduli partner. And because the axion, this solution is very much like the axion, where I care about the minimum of the potential, this solves the hierarchy problem regardless, independent of the value of f. And so the question is then, okay, so as I vary f, what are the couplings and what are the masses and are they constrained? So roughly speaking, the parametrically, the mass of this moduli is roughly TeV squared over f. And the mixing with the Higgs is roughly speaking 10 TeV over f. So using these rough scalings, you can say if f is smaller than 10 to the 7 GeV, we'll actually be hit by things like beam dumps. So this red line here was basically this parameter space. And you see that it basically, until the mass gets smaller than
the space for what?
The moduli.
The mass, what's n squared theta?
Theta is the mixing with the Higgs.
Oh, okay. So, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And here is just the mass. And so this line is this one relationship that I had. And so if the moduli was heavier than 10 GeV, it would be hit by things like branching decays of the Higgs. And then once it becomes lighter than like a few, essentially twice the muon mass, it gets hit, starts being hit by rare meson decays and sort of beam dump experiments. And then once it's lighter than like 10 MeV, you're basically scot-free. Until you hit stellar cooling. So stellar cooling basically hits when your mass is lighter than about 10 keV or so. And then, so that's this lower bound here. And then the upper bound eventually just couples too weakly to cool stars.
Sorry, what about supernovae? Why?
Supernovae end up being not as, so it's essentially just because I only have a single line through parameter space, by the time supernova are important, the essentially stellar cooling becomes more important.
This is a couple. How does it exactly, does it couple? It doesn't couple like a max.
No, it couples through mixings with the Higgs. So it's a scalar. These are all scalar couplings.
So mixing with the Higgs.
Yeah.
So these are all scalar couplings. And you're saying that if you look at the line, then it just goes all below the bound.
Yeah, that's right.
So the end is the coupling to the electron through the Higgs. That's
And then, I mean, this bound is roughly from like Robert's work, where he basically showed that the stellar coolings are actually much stronger than people had thought.
Yeah.
And so,
I mean, above that, in the sort of when your mass is lighter than 10 MeV, you'd worry about BBM and stuff.
Yeah.
So then, there's presumably something in that region as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and then you can keep on taking f larger, and you might worry that just like the axion, you can take f to order m Planck and then never see anything. However, because it's a scalar, if you take f of order m Planck, you start getting hit by fifth force constraints. And so actually, because the mass becomes macroscopic in size, f cannot be larger than 10 to the 17 GeV. So you can't even make this moduli too weakly coupled. And so it's sort of cute that essentially what happens is you only get two regions of parameter space with, roughly speaking, their mass. So essentially between stellar cooling and beam dumps, or between stellar cooling and fifth force. And so it's sort of cute that you can get hit by like all these different ranges, different types of experiments, and it can't even be too weakly coupled. So you have some hope of excluding it, though these are like four orders of parameter space, four orders and three. And so it's still, you have to improve current experiments by a lot to probe it. And just like the axion, it can be dark matter if you want it to be. I mean, it's slightly heavier. It's a scalar. It's not a pseudoscalar, but essentially the whole very similar. Okay, so obviously there's still a lot to do. My dream is to make sure that is if there were a way to make it so that there are only three copies of the Higgs and not three copies of the standard model. That would be ideal. It'd be nice if I could somehow use this to solve the big hierarchy rather than the small hierarchy. And like, for example, a better way of getting a negative Higgs mass. But to me, the most interesting thing about all of this is that despite calculating everything and showing that it actually works, there's not a very good theory understanding for why it works. So if you actually look at any example we know of self-organized criticality, people don't have a general way, a general understanding of why it happens. And so basically, there's no way to write a model building machine, which is right if you understand things like supersymmetry, little Higgs, twin Higgs, whatever. You can just write a computer program that just generates models ad infinitum. Whereas for these cases, self-organized criticality has made its appearance in many fields of biology, computer science, all over the place. And never has it actually been understood enough to do something similar to that and make a model generating machine. And so to me, that's sort of the most interesting part, is just trying to understand what aspects of this are critical to making it work, which are not. There are two examples we know of in field theory, the simplest one being the dilaton, with its quartic coupling being self-tuned to zero, and this example of the mass. And most of the lessons you draw from one cannot be applied to the other. So it's not entirely clear to me what is critical to make this mechanism work and what's to understand it. And so to me, that's sort of the most exciting thing as a theorist, is just like, we see something, we can calculate and show that it works, but why it works, like in our heart, can we get a good physical intuitive understanding? That doesn't exist. And so to me, that's pretty exciting. All right, thanks.
Your analogy with self-organized criticality. So in the case of a sand, the critical, the important quantity is
the angle. Yeah.
So what's the analog of the...
That would be, let's say for the dilaton, it's the quartic coupling. Why does the quartic coupling just go towards zero? Mm-hmm. Like for the sand, you'd think the natural value is theta equals zero, right? It's completely flat. And so for the dilaton, the natural value is like order one. But suddenly it becomes really small and it's not clear why.
And for the, I see. So for the realistic model, the Higgs mm-hmm. model, the thing, is the Higgs mass the analog of?
Yeah, the Higgs mass is the analog of the angle, yeah.
It's more like the Higgs mass is the analog of the deviation from the preferred
angle. Yeah, that's right.
But anyway, I hear the words and it sounds very plausible. I just cannot trace it to your mm-hmm. model that you presented, but we can do this after.
Yeah, let's
you can show
we can do it later.
Yeah, I cannot, anyway, I don't see it in your model.
Mm-hmm.
Well, maybe to follow up on Sabas's question, so you did need to invoke for the dilaton case this operator with a very specific dimension.
Yeah, that's right.
And so
that's
like, is it
like, how natural is it to, is that necessary that you might have this accidental thing of some operator that's very close to four? And then, but then I look at the Higgs example and be like, well, that doesn't look like it has anything like that. But then it also has its own issues and coincidences that need to occur. And then seems like there's always this sort of self tuning thing isn't a generic feature ever, but it's not clear what is, is there something that always needs to be like small, or is there something that, or is it just in each case, are these just like isolated points in theory space?
Can I ask a really basic question? The UV completion scale is essentially like few TV or 10 TV.
10 TV, yeah.
Yeah, few TV. So, I mean, if I add arbitrary symmetry consistent non-renormalizable garbage to the potential
mm-hmm.
with that fairly modest suppression scale, what does it do?
So because I only solve the little hierarchy problem,
right.
It's okay. You will mess things up, and basically you can rephrase any problem that ever comes up as what's the size of this extra, what are the size of these extra wiggles on top? And
they're really arbitrary wiggles. I mean,
in principle, they're whatever some arbitrary size. And the statement is just when you write higher dimensional operators, you get them from integrating stuff out. So you get weak couplings, you get loop factors. And because I'm only solving this little hierarchy problem, those suppressions are enough.
But if I did just put in a set of dimension six operators with a TV or a 10 TV cutoff, the wiggles here would probably be too severe in order for this to work out.
So if you put it literally the UV cutoff, it's going to be, I think actually that's still okay. Because for some reason or another, what matters here, well, it depends on what value of n is. Because there's some generalized cos cubed, cos to the fourth, cos to the fifth identities, higher dimensional operators also get highly suppressed. So like if I really wanted to put h to the 6 over lambda squared, and I really wanted to say this has zero effect at all, I would have to take n, I think 5 or larger, and then it'd be okay. But if I don't, if I take small n, then I become more sensitive to higher dimensional operators. Yeah. And so essentially, what in general, what protects me from UV contributions is generalized cosine squared identities. So it's cosine squared, it's cosine cubed, cosine to the fourth, dot, dot, all the way up to n minus 1.
Standard model, if you count color, the isospin, spin, there are 45 particles.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have three copies, I might be misunderstood. 3 times 45 is 135.
Yeah.
That's quite a proliferation of particles.
Yeah. I mean, when Dirac solved the self-energy problem, he doubled the number of particles.
Observed.
Yeah. I agree. That's the whole point of anything we do, is to make make observables. I agree.
We can quibble about details, but he was quite explicit about what the experimental signatures would be, right?
Yeah.
That I think is okay. Like he talked about stellar bounds, about the axis, about the beam bounds.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like that's what you do. Like,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's okay.
And then
supersymmetry, we double the Nova particles.
Mm-hmm.
This is not supersymmetry.
Yeah.
Does this I've seen in the inflationary model building community, people have been getting into like these random field models or theories with many axions, and then they invoke these properties of random matrix theory that like, you know, the eigenvalues.
Eigenvalue repulsion and things like that, yeah.
I mean, is this related to that in some sense? If you made n large, it's almost exactly the same setup, except for you're looking for a minima and not maxima.
Yeah.
In some sense.
And it's also a very specific Spurian structure. So if you allow, so I had said that the Spurian of symmetry breaking was some epsilon sine, which means if I want higher frequency terms, I have to square this operator. But if I had higher frequency terms that were not suppressed by epsilon to the, like if I had a sine squared that wasn't epsilon to the fourth, then a lot of the story would start falling apart. And so that means if I UV complete this into a strong coupled theory, which is usually what happens in these large N matrix models, right? They're just like, with analogy of the axion, you get a potential by some strong coupling, then a lot of the story will fall apart. And so you do need a weak coupling UV completion here, which lends itself more towards something like supersymmetry as a UV completion and whatnot, but yeah.
So can you tell us if this theory is true? So what's the first thing that will be seen?
It'll likely be the modulus here. Let's see, if it's F, where is it? Here you go. So it is either rare meson decay or beam dumps. So I guess the four thing places where you would.
Is there an anomaly in rare meson
decays? There are tons of flavor anomalies. And so the answer is always yes. That's a time invariant statement. It's just which anomaly changes, but yeah.
So continue.
So rare mesons, beam dump, stellar cooling, or fifth force. And in terms of actually showing that it really is this particle, that's sort of difficult. the hope is that you be, if it sits on this line, just like the axion, if it happens to sit on the axion line, you're like, it's probably the axion, even though you can write models where it isn't. And just like this, if it happens to sit on the line, I'd say it's probably this particle, but it doesn't need to be.
Yeah, since I don't know,
and so,
but in other theories, twin Higgs, etc., mm-hmm. are there things that would reproduce such signals?
So at things like rare meson and beam dump, yes. Not in stellar cooling or in the fifth force.
Need to see more Higgs.
I'd be happy with any new particles, not just the Higgs.
I don't see any at present.
Yeah, that's correct.
Are there things you'd have to worry about in the cosmology?
Yeah, so the cosmology is kind of weird because cosmology breaks the Z3 symmetry because we are reheated but not the other guys. And so that leads to all sorts of problems. But if you take a low reheat temperature below electroweak scale,
yes, that's what you want.
Then things are fine. And actually, this modulus naturally only reheats the R sector and not the others because it couples through mixing with the Higgs. And so it decays through an off-shell Higgs. And so you want the least off-shell Higgs, which is the lightest sector. And so, yeah.
Sounds familiar.
Sounds familiar, yes.